Welcome to the Human Rights 2020s podcast, brought to you by the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. In this episode, an introduction to the Human Rights Incorporation Bill, our director, Barry Snowden, explains the basics of this important bill and why it matters. It was recorded on the 20th of March 2023 as part of our Incorporation Fortnight series. We hope you enjoy this episode.
So good morning, everyone, on this rather dreich Monday morning. I don't know how it is with you. It's lovely to see some faces and names I know, but if I've not met you before, my name is Vary Snowden, Director of the Human Rights Consortium Scotland, which is a civil society network to protect and defend human rights. So the purpose of this 1 hour whistle stop tour is to look at the incorporation of Human Rights Bill. We're going to look at some of the big picture. We're going to look at some of the details. We're going to consider the impact that it could have and what's happening with it now. So the first thing to say, though, is that funnily, when we're having this event about this incorporation bill, it is not written yet. So we don't actually know exactly what the bill will look like. There are a lot of details to be worked out. But what we are talking about today is what we know that the Scottish Government has committed to. So 2 years ago this month, a national task force on human rights leadership that I was a member of published a whole host of recommendations for this bill and what should be in it. And what is important to note is that the Scottish Government committed to those recommendations. They accepted them in full and they said this bill will be passed by the end of this parliamentary session, which is May 2026. So actually that is a commitment that we are holding the government to, and I know a lot of you are as well. So this session today will for some of us be a reminder, for some of us just raise new questions and a new way of looking at things. And I think especially a reminder of why we need to do this and the impact that it could have, as well as a little bit about what is happening with the bill now. So 2 years on, where are we at? What's happened so far? So the first thing to say is that, as you know, like the core purpose and principle of human rights is dignity. So that everyone should be treated with dignity and respect, that no one, that the government should not be able to trample over any person. They should not be able to ignore any person as if they have no value, because actually everybody has value and should be treated with dignity. So that's a core principle of our international human rights. And actually the task force said that should be in the purpose clause of this bill. So the big purpose of the whole bill is that people should be treated with dignity. And here's the thing, this bill is not about us in Scotland deciding what those human rights should be. It's not debate about what they should look like, who they should apply to, what do we think are the priorities. Actually, this is about international human rights that are already agreed, brought closer to home. So there are a whole raft of international human rights agreements that the UK has signed up to, and they don't do that lightly. But over the last few decades, actually, the UK government has signed up to these and agreed to implement them. But they are at an international level, and what this bill will do will bring more of them to Scotland, as we'll look at. Well, please don't get turned off by this, because sometimes I think when we talk about the UN, it seems a little bit airy-fairy and far away. But it's important to actually get that context in first, in terms of this bill. Well, at that international level, there are two big chunks of human rights that we all have, no matter who we are, no matter what we have done, no matter where we are from, no matter what we look like. The first of these is what is called the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights. So these are what are kind of maybe our hard nut kind of rights. They are what most people think of when you mention the term human rights. So they include lots of freedoms like freedom from torture, freedom of association, freedom of expression, freedom of religion and belief, things like the right to life, really fundamental freedoms. And these civil and political rights are also reflected in the European Convention on Human Rights. Just to note that although that has European in the title, it is nothing to do with the EU, really, as there's connections, but we are still in it. Even though we've left the EU, we are still in the European Convention on Human Rights. And what is important to note is that that convention was brought closer to home through the Human Rights Act in 1998, when it was incorporated into UK law. So that chunk of our international human rights have been brought closer to home. There is another chunk of our international human rights, which are our economic, social and cultural rights, which again is a little bit of a mouthful. But these are really important. Some people call them our everyday rights. I mean, honestly, every human right is for every day, but they're about the basics that we all need. So they include really practical things like right to an adequate standard of living. And that includes the right to adequate housing, the right to food. It talks about food that is affordable, about that is healthy, that is nutritious, that is culturally appropriate. It includes things like the right to the highest attainable level of physical and mental health. That's not the right to be healthy, but it includes a lot about healthcare services, about how you can access them, about everyone's equal access to those services, including in prevention. It includes the right to social security, the right to education, the right to access, take part in, and contribute to cultural life, and more. So that just gives you a picture of some of these basic human rights that are included in this covenant. And what's important to know that we, you and I, have these human rights now. They are not in doubt. And actually, what's interesting is they're actually spelled out quite a lot at an international level. Now, but just to give you some headlines, because I think it's helpful to know that actually all of these international human rights have got good, strong definitions. So it includes security, this is the human right to adequate housing, includes security of tenure, includes the availability of services. So that's things like water and sanitation and the bins. It includes affordability, includes habitability, which I find quite difficult to say, but it includes accessibility, it includes the location. So it's not okay if the housing is really cut off from where you need to live. It includes cultural adequacy. So that's just to give you a picture of the fact that these are really spelled out. And actually, at an international level, there is also recognition that we all have these human rights, but there are some groups that face particular barriers. And that's why there are also group rights treaties. So, for example, for women's rights, there's what's called CEDAW. So in short, that's Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. So in short, CEDAW. There's a UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, for children and young people's rights. There's the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. So that's disabled people's rights. and the International Covenant for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, ICERD, which is rights related to race. And at an international level, it is recognised that these groups face particular barriers to rights, and also that unless we build in consideration of these groups in particular, we know that they will miss out. So, for example, we know that if a policy is just written in general without specifically considering how it impacts women, we know that it will not work for women. And so that is how these group rights treaties sit alongside those things. So what about bringing them then into our law here? So the plan is, as I said before, we already have the Human Rights Act 1998, so that's our civil and political rights. Back in March, 2 years ago as well, there was a bill passed to incorporate the UNCRC, so that's the Children's Rights Convention, into Scots law. We are still waiting on that bill being amended so that it can be started, because it ended up in the Supreme Court and then there are amendments needed. We need to see that soon, because 2 years is a long time in children's lives. But we have those two elements in our law, or about to be in our law already. So the task force said, and the government accepted, that there should be in the Scottish Human Rights Incorporation Bill, that there should be, first of all, those economic, social and cultural rights, so that incorporation of ICESCR, that covenant on those things, directly in Scots law. Task force said, and the government accepted, that there should also be incorporation of the Treaty for Women's Rights, Disabled People's Rights, and the Treaty on Race. Those should also be a part of the bill. Then the task force said there should also be right to a healthy environment. Now, this is really important, because actually what we recognise is that if you don't have things like clean air, clean water, clean places to play without the air you breathe making you ill, then you can't have your other human rights. That it's really tied together. And that's increasingly recognised at the UN as well. In just October last year, the UN Human Rights Council agreed a resolution that said that we all should have the human right to a healthy environment. So the government has committed to putting that into the bill as well. The task force also said that there should be some form of equality clause in the bill that really says we need to make sure that everyone can access these rights equally, and with paid particular attention to older people and to LGBTI people, particularly because there's a sense that if they're not in this bill specifically, again, they might be forgotten. So that is the big picture in terms of the plans for the bill. But why, just a quick word about why do we need to bring our international human rights closer to home? Well, actually, if they stay at that international level, it is really difficult to actually use those human rights to get change and for individuals to be able to take those human rights and advocate for them. So to bring them home will mean that all public authorities will have a duty to comply with them. And this means that actually human rights will become central. Like, they need to be taken seriously and they need to actually shape decisions. So rather than something that is just guiding or best practice or a nice idea, these will actually become binding. And so public authorities will be required to build in consideration of these, of human rights in all the decisions they take. And that's decisions at a strategic kind of policy level, but also the decisions that directly affect one person's life or one family's life. It means that actually, our international human rights become that baseline. So it's almost constitutional in nature. So the Human Rights Act already is at that constitutional foundation, really, of all our law and policy. And so bringing more of our international human rights in will mean that those also are part of that baseline across everything else. It means that they become like a sieve. So apologies if you're not into images. I quite like images to describe things. So the sieve means that all law and policy, the way we do things, needs to go through that human rights sieve. It needs to comply. And if it doesn't, it should be chucked out. So it becomes like the test of everything else. Ultimately, if we bring these international human rights home, it means that people will then be able to name and claim their rights. It really gives them teeth. And that means ultimately, even in court, if necessary. Now, nobody wants everybody, loads of people to end up in court. This is not what this is about. And actually, we know from the experience of the Human Rights Act that that does not happen. But we also know that for some people, we absolutely need that teeth of enforceability in court in order for those human rights to be taken seriously and for people who will otherwise be ignored to be heard. So we know at the moment that it's only the Human Rights Act that means that some people have a voice. And bringing more of our international human rights home will mean that people will be able to have a voice on those really basics that they need to live. If there's no other way for them to do so, then they can take the public authority to court. So it gives them teeth. So that is the big picture of what we're about. So what I thought I would do is just, in terms of the detail, give you a picture of four different elements of this bill will also need to be there. I'm very aware that there were a whole number of recommendations from the task force. I'm probably about to miss some of the smaller details, but I thought it'd be helpful to give you these four major elements. So first of all, the task force said, and the government accepted, that there should be new duties then on public authorities. They said there should be something called a sunrise clause. It's really a way of recognising that this is a big deal and we want public authorities to properly think through what needs to change for them to comply with this. And so we do need to give them a bit of time to do so. So this bill will build in a sunrise clause. So they will have some form of duty to start preparing. That might be through a duty to have due regard, which basically just have due regard to these rights. It might look like something else, but something that they have to have start to prepare, and then will come that duty to comply. And that's where that ability to name and claim your rights comes in. The task force also said that we should define minimum core obligations. So this is a really helpful term, but it really means that we bring those international human rights into Scots law in a way that we can be very clear if they are met or not. So it means defining what these are. What are the absolute floor minimums related to your human rights? So we're not talking here about anything beyond that, but there is that in human rights terms, actually, if you define what are the minimums that need to be met for everybody. So these need to be feasible. They are not aspirational. They are absolute basics that should be provided no matter who you are, including, can I just say, including for people who are caught up in the immigration system. It applies to them too. And that these minimum core obligations should be defined through looking at international standards, but also through a participation in Scotland. So discussions and conversations to come to an agreed understanding of what those minimums are. The task force also said that there should be an explicit duty of progressive realisation. So this is something that comes from that international covenant on economic, social and cultural rights. And it really just means not going backwards on human rights, but actually always taking concrete, deliberate steps to improve rights made real for all. This is really important because we don't want our human rights law and what people are doing to result in some sort of narrow tick box compliance. Actually, they should always be looking at who is missing out. How can we extend human rights? How can we fulfill them more fully? What does that look like? That's the first bit. The second bit around access to justice. So the task force said that there should be consideration of how this new legal framework of this bill will make sure that the routes to remedy, as in when you've got a problem with one of your human rights, that it is not being met, how do you get a solution to that? How do you get it sorted? And how do you hold the government to account for what it has done or not done? Those routes to remedy must be accessible, affordable, effective, and timely. And those principles, again, come from international framework. Just a note here that, as we'll go on to say, there has been a lived experience board meeting. I think there's a couple of members of that board here today. And actually, because of their discussions, we're suggesting that there should be a fifth principle, actually, that is something around that those routes to remedy need to be supportive or person-centred or empowering, because what we know is that accessing justice just has such a huge emotional toll on people. It is exhausting. You can get justice, but you can be in tatters by the end. So there is a fifth principle we suggest should be in there. But the task force also said that there should be both judicial, as in going to court, routes to remedy, but also non-judicial, so things that you don't have to go all the way to court to get the remedy. It should make more test cases or strategic cases possible, and that the SHRC, which is the Scottish Human Rights Commission, should have enhanced kind of teeth powers. So they should have more ability to hold public bodies to account. And actually, arguably, so should the Children and Young People's Commissioner in this bill as well. Third thing is around reporting and accountability. So yes, you'd be able to take cases to court or other routes to get remedy, but we need public authorities to show what they are doing to make human rights real, and especially on the progressive realisation, on those taking steps. And so the task force said that the Scottish Government should have a duty to publish a human rights scheme. For those who know a bit about this, this is similar to the Children's Rights Scheme in the UNCRC bill. And basically, this scheme will set out what the Scottish Government are doing to implement this law. It says it should include things like how they are taking human rights into consideration in their budgets and how they put the budget together. It includes this Scotland's National Action Plan on Human Rights. And it will also include how, when public authorities have to write their reports on what they are doing to implement this law. Now, I've got to say that when you look at the task force report around this whole area, it's a little bit scant, actually. It needs more detail, because we know that we don't want this just to become one of these processes and a bit tick boxy. So you see those questions there about raise, well, who will monitor these reports in this human rights scheme? Maybe the human rights scheme will be laid before Parliament. Will there be consequences if these reports are basically poor or not very good? How will these reports demonstrate actual improvements for people and not just high level theory, or not just what is being done, but actually have they led to change? So how will they reflect lived experience? And how will we make sure they're not just tick box exercises? Just to flag again that the Lived Experience Board had a whole block looking at around this, and there's some really strong advice to the government on what that should look like. Now, this next one, I'm not going to go into hugely, but to say that the task force report also included quite a lot around implementation. So guidance, information on your rights, public awareness campaign that it should be resourced, and more. But what we hear continually, and I'm sure you agree, is that sense of please don't let this law sit on the shelf. That's a quote from a project that we had to inform the task force. There's no point in passing this bill unless it is fully implemented and brings a change. So we need all the elements to make sure that that happens. And we have been saying to the government, please don't wait for this bill to be passed before you start putting in place the plans for implementation. That needs to start this year, because this is no small thing. This is a major thing. So it needs to be planned for. So just a few words on what this bill will change and the impact it will have. And so fundamentally, this bill will mean that fulfilling human rights for minority groups will not be an optional thing. It's not an option, it will be essential. So it means that you'll not be relying on the politics or goodwill or even a great campaign for the likes of us and people on this call, but actually in law there'll be a requirement for public authorities to fulfil all of our human rights for minority groups. It will shine a light on who is missing out, because there should be no one left behind on these economic, social and cultural rights. This includes things like having an intersectional way of looking at things. So that means not just looking, for example, at all disabled people who might miss out, but actually thinking about the diversity of disabled people's experiences, and building into that, thinking about, well, what about disabled women? Do they face particular barriers? What about disabled people who are from minority ethnic groups? Are they facing particular barriers? What about disabled people who are LGBTI? Are they facing particular barriers? And asking always, who is missing out? And that means that, for example, we'll have to really improve our data collection. It's not that exciting, but it makes such a difference. So public authorities will need to measure what they need to know in order to answer that question of who is missing out. It will change the way that public services are planned and delivered sometimes, because actually if someone's human rights are not being fulfilled at the end of the day, then maybe the process or the service has to change. So the emphasis in human rights is always the outcome for someone, not the process. It might change the way that budgets are prioritised, and actually it could change the way that different public bodies look across their budgets to make sure people's human rights are fulfilled. It should lead to new ways that enable participation in decision-making. Participation is a crucial human rights principle. It's actually in that international covenant that we're going to bring into our law. So actually, this bill must lead to more participation in big strategic level, but also having a say about your own life, that you should have the agency in decisions that affect your life. As I said before, people will be empowered to name and claim their rights. It will be clear if they're being met or not, and they'll be able to do something about it if they're not. And it should change the way that conversations every day take place. So the question should not be, will you protect my human rights? But how are you going to protect my human rights? So it is important to note that this bill is highly complex. So it incorporates multiple treaties that are international, remember, they're not designed specifically sometimes for Scotland. So how do you incorporate them and together? As I said, it's almost at that constitutional, foundational kind of level. And it affects everything. It affects so many things. And one of the challenges is it affects every public authority, every bit of the Scottish government. And actually, for us from civil society, it is potentially a tool, a lever, and something that all of us should be concerned about. So it is highly complex. It is very ambitious. So this is likely to be the biggest bill that the Scottish Parliament has dealt with. It is breaking new ground. So in some ways, the UNCRC bill has gone ahead, and so it can reflect a lot of that. But this is a new thing to bring all of these treaties. It's new in the UK. There's no easy template, even across the world, that we can draw on. So it is breaking new ground. And of course, we are in the midst of devolution being in flux. So we know that the constraints of devolution, how it's dealt with, how it's understood, has changed hugely in recent years, not least of which with the UNCRC ending up in the Supreme Court, but also more recently with Article 35 and the Gender Recognition Bill. So we're in the midst of a very complex devolution situation. And to note again, we are still waiting on that UNCRC bill to be commenced. So this bill is being very much written in the midst of that complexity of ever-changing devolution. We can come back to that if that's helpful. But it's also being written in the midst of going backwards on human rights protections at Westminster. So I'm sure you will have seen the news reports, for example, about the inhumane immigration refugee bill. It is not on, and it's about making some human rights not apply to some of us. Human rights are for all of us. And so we see serious regression on human rights protections at Westminster. And this bill is in the midst of this. So this bill is only about things within devolution. So things within the remit of the Scottish government and the Scottish Parliament. So it can happen regardless, but nonetheless, it is also happening in the context of that regression at Westminster. But we also know in the midst of all of those things, just all too well, about the daily infringements of these economic, social and cultural rights. I know that you know about the people who are missing out on them. We know that big things like COVID, like the cost of living crisis, austerity, and actually years of persistent poverty are the context for this. That means it is absolutely essential. So we think that actually bringing all of these international human rights home is one of the most important steps we can take to actually make them real. So there will not be a so hot about human rights, like as in you have those human rights, so what? Actually, they will be made real. So what has happened in the last 2 years then? What has happened? So bearing in mind that this bill is complex, it is constitutional, and it's highly ambitious. And that is some of the reason for the last 2 years and the, in some ways, the slowness of the development does reflect that. But it does also reflect the fact that we need the government to prioritise this and to put plenty of resource into it. So over the last 2 years, there has been an executive board, which is mostly public bodies, an advisory board, which is mostly civil society, set up by the Scottish Government. There have been three lived experience boards, one of people with learning disabilities, one of children and young people, and a third one that we facilitated on behalf of the government, which is a wide diversity of people in it. And the purpose of those boards is to give advice to the government on how to make sure this works in practice for people. So it's not written just by people sitting behind a desk in theory, but in practice. And you can see all of the reports of these boards on our website. But they are really, really good and really strong in terms of what they tell the government must be in this bill and around this bill to make it work. There's obviously been a bill team within the government. One of our concerns was that this was in no way big enough, that they weren't, didn't have enough people in it. It is increasing in size. And then they've been having a lot of meetings with different groups and different organisations to develop the detail of this bill. So the consultation then, the public consultation on the bill has been significantly delayed. We expected it a year ago and it's now going to be by June this year. We need to hold them to that because they have repeatedly said that it'll be published by June. So we are waiting for that to happen. And I've no reason to expect it won't. So. But that's helpful if you're from an organisation, actually. Will you be ready to respond to that consultation and engage in that from June at the latest this year? We know there'll be 4 months to respond. There'll be a variety of ways to respond. There'll be some in-person kind of town hall meetings. There'll be an online version, different ways. And from a consortium point of view, we'll be doing loads. So we will have meetings that you can come along to tease out the detail, to hear more, to ask questions. We'll be producing a guide to responding in case that's helpful. And we'll be doing a joint response ourselves that the organisations can sign up to. That might be particularly relevant if you're from a little organisation. And also just to say, you know, get in touch if you want to talk about it when it's published. If your organisation is not a member of the consortium, here's a shameless plug, then please do sign up. It is free and very light touch and hopefully just helpful. So just a reminder again then, saying actually there has been a repeated commitment to pass this bill in this parliamentary session, and that's by May 2026. So we need to hold the government to that. It was in the SNP manifesto as a commitment. The UNCRC bill being amended and the bill consultation were in the programme for government just in the autumn there. So that must happen this year. Again, we must hold them to that. And as a group of organisations, we have written to the three First Minister candidates, not, can I say, not to ask them if they will pass this bill, because that is not up for discussion. It's a phrase I often use with my kids, but they're just not discussing this anymore. It is not up for discussion because they've committed to it. This is the same Scottish government with the same manifesto. But asking them to reassure us that they will prioritise getting this done. So far, we've only had Hamza Yousaf reply, who said or who published a statement saying, absolutely, we will get this bill passed and it's really important. So we are waiting to hear from the two other candidates. So I suppose if you're from a small organisation, I wonder, or any kind of organisation or as an individual, I wonder if you are planning to respond to the consultation? Are there ways that you can show the impact that this will have and the need for this bill in terms of those who are missing out on their rights just now? And as soon as the consultation is published, that's when we will be producing from the consortium a guide to responding, which will hopefully be helpful, as well as having other discussions at the time. So I think, I hope that's been a helpful, quite a whistle stop tour in this hour, but hopefully helpful to give you almost a flavour of the bill, what it's going to look like, and actually why it is so important that we get this done and make sure it's done well. Okay, so thank you everybody. And have a good rest of your day.
Thank you for listening to the Human Rights 2020s podcast. For more information about our work as Scotland's civil society network for the protection and promotion of human rights, please visit our website at www.hrcscotland.org or follow us on Twitter at @hrcscotland. Thank you.